From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as the Senate votes on the debt ceiling extension, we look at how Speaker Boehner's actions have played out in his own party.
Certainly an acknowledgement by Republicans that their past behaviour has been problematic.
Also today, President Obama signs an executive order raising the minimum wage for hundreds of thousands of federal contractors. Some of the hardest hit parts of South Sudan finally start receiving aid, more than 2 months after fighting began. And the benefits of mammograms in the battle against breast cancer are thrown into doubt.
Both the medical profession and the public has bought into the idea of screening, that finding things early should always improve things. That's just not the case.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Hume. The US Senate has approved a one-year extension to the country's debt ceiling. Lawmakers agreed to the move by 67 votes to 31 in a dramatic vote this Wednesday afternoon, after debate time was shortened ahead of an approaching snowstorm. From FSN's headquarters in Washington, Lorna Shaddick reports.
Today's vote was necessary because the US Treasury had signalled it was likely to come to the end of its current borrowing limit by the 27th of February. That would have put federal payments at risk and meant the government could have started to default on some of its payment obligations. President Obama and his fellow Democrats demanded that the debt ceiling be raised without any conditions. But Republican Senator Ted Cruz had said he wanted meaningful conditions attached that would help reduce deficits. Normally, that would have stretched out debate time in the Senate for a couple of days. But with a winter storm approaching the D.C. area, senators agreed to waive the required debate time so the vote could happen before they left Washington. Eventually, after an hour-long voting process, 12 Republican senators sided with the Democrats to push the measure through. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
U.S. President Obama's announced the new minimum wage of $10.10 an hour starting next year. Meanwhile, Secretary of State John Kerry's heading to South Korea for his fifth trip to the Asia-Pacific region. UN-backed relief and evacuation operations continue in the besieged old city of Homs after a temporary halting of the agreed truce on Tuesday. Another 200 civilians have been allowed out, with almost 200 food parcels containing flour, rice and oil entering into the city. Those allowed to leave are mainly women and children. Many men of military age have been held back for questioning. The Syrian regime says it is considering an extension to the current ceasefire, which is due to end late Wednesday. Central African Republic President Catherine Samba-Panza has come out and said she is ready to go to war with Christian rebels responsible for the slaughter of Muslims in the Central African nation. Christian militia groups say they are taking revenge for killings carried out by Muslims last year. Amnesty International is calling the situation ethnic cleansing. The sectarian fighting has also led to a food crisis. FSN's William Denslow reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
Militia attacks in the Central African Republic have led to what Amnesty International describes as a, quote, Muslim exodus of historical proportions. The rebel Muslim Salika force stepped down in January after taking control of the country last year, but sectarian attacks have continued. With almost a quarter of the country displaced because of the fighting, the UN food programme began a month-long aid airlift on Wednesday. This follows remarks made by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on Tuesday, urging France to send more troops to the CAR, stating that the international response does not, quote, match the gravity of the situation. William Denslow, New York.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A New York federal judge has set the trial date for Boston Marathon bombing suspect Johar Tsarnaev at a hearing in Boston. The trial is due to begin in November. A controversial law putting an end to a woman's right to abortion in Spain is set to be passed after a challenge by the parliamentary opposition was defeated in Madrid. Scores of protesters across the country have taken to the streets to try and prevent the bill becoming law. From FSN's Europe Bureau, Jack Parrock reports.
The Spanish government is set to bring in legislation which will mean women in the country will have to prove they have been raped or that having a baby will have serious negative effects on their health in order to receive an abortion. The draft bill was originally approved in December but was challenged by left-wing opposition. A vote in the Spanish Parliament on Wednesday, which has a solid Conservative majority, upheld the proposal. Under current laws in Spain, women can choose to have an abortion up to 22 weeks into their pregnancy. Pro-choice activists protesting the law say they fear if it's introduced, it will force women to look for unsafe ways to terminate their pregnancies. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
British Prime Minister David Cameron has been chairing a COBRA-level meeting from Downing Street. That's to oversee the UK's flood response. Forecasters are warning they could see as much as a month's rainfall in the coming days. Authorities have issued 16 severe flood warnings across the south of the country. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Hume reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. In a dramatic vote Wednesday, the Senate cleared crucial legislation to extend the debt ceiling into next year. After the House passed a clean bill on Tuesday, senators pushed to get the bill approved before a snowstorm hits the Capitol this evening. Earlier, I discussed the deal and the reaction to Speaker Boehner's debt ceiling gamble with Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report.
Well, it's certainly an acknowledgement by Republicans that their past behavior has been problematic. And we are now just a few months out from an election where right now Republicans look poised for some pickups, potentially even picking up the Senate. So Republicans want to minimize their self-inflicted wounds.
This was a victory for President Obama. Has this demoralized certain factions within the Republican Party? And has Speaker Boehner committed sort of party suicide here?
What he allowed Republicans to do was to vote no on a debt ceiling, make Democrats vote for it. You get no brinkmanship. We don't have a blame game about who defaulted on the debt. And you move on to live to fight another day. So, you know, most Republicans were able now to go back to their districts and say, I voted against a debt ceiling increase, right? But they can do that without also saying, oh, by the way, my vote caused either a government shutdown or a default on our debt. So to me, it was incredibly pragmatic what Boehner did, and that it also gave Republicans a victory in that they can get this issue off the table and spend more time talking about the stuff they want to talk about.
Does this vote suggest a strategy shift within the Republican Party towards tackling economic issues and the economic recovery of the United States?
It does suggest that they recognize when you start playing with things like the debt ceiling and funding for the government and what else we had, the fiscal cliff, that the brinkmanship battle is a losing one for Republicans. They're going to lose it every time. And so if they want to get themselves back into a place where they can be seen as good stewards of the economy and trustworthy in terms of, you know, their priorities, putting their priorities out there, then I think they will do better. But, you know, if you look at where Republicans continue to fall behind Democrats, it's on the issue, first of all, of just, you know, who do you like better? It's not as if voters love Democrats, but they dislike them less than they dislike Republicans. And the second is, who's looking out for you? Which party do you think is standing up for the regular average American? And that is a metric by which Republicans continue to fall behind Democrats. And they are not going to be successful in a national campaign until they can turn that around. And the best way to turn that around is to not get into fights where it looks like they're, hurting people by shutting the government down or by, you know, creating panic in stock market. So, again, that's the first step. The next step is going to be, can they keep this up and keep focused? And the next is going to be, can they can they find a way as a party to narrow that gap with Democrats about who's looking out for you? And that's the challenge I think you'll see, not just for Republicans at the congressional level, but ultimately for the 2016 Republican nominee for president.
Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report. This is FSN Reports. President Obama signed an executive order today raising the minimum wage for hundreds of thousands of federal contractors. The wage hike only applies to new contracts, not existing ones, and doesn't go into effect until 2015. The president also called on Congress to pass a bill raising pay for all workers, noting that current wages have less purchasing power than they did in the 1960s. But such a move faces stiff opposition from conservatives, many of whom favour keeping pay where it is, and some of whom want to do away with a minimum wage entirely. On Capitol Hill, our correspondent Alice Olstein has the details.
Just before signing an executive order to lift the wages of federal contractors, President Obama noted that their pay has lost a fifth of its value since Ronald Reagan was in the White House, as raises have lagged behind the rate of inflation.
Right now, there's a dishwasher at Randolph Air Force Base in Texas making $7.70 an hour, $7.76 an hour. There's a fast food worker at Andrews right down the street making $8.91 an hour. There's a laundry worker at Camp Dodge in Iowa making $9.03 an hour. Once I sign this order, starting next year, as their contracts come up, each of them and many of their fellow co-workers are going to get a raise. And by the way, that includes folks who get paid in tips.
The president also called on members of Congress to pass a bill that raises the federal minimum wage for all workers, noting that a growing number of states and local counties have already done so over the past year.
10-10. Let's get that done. Raise the federal minimum wage to 10-10 wouldn't just raise wages for minimum wage workers. Its effect would lift wages for about 28 million Americans. It would lift millions of Americans out of poverty immediately. It would help millions more work their way out of poverty without requiring a single dollar in new taxes or spending. It's the right thing to do.
The president did not acknowledge Wednesday the many walkouts, strikes, and protests that low-wage federal workers at the Pentagon, the Smithsonian Museums, and at D.C.'s Union Station have held over the past several months, demanding the president do exactly what he did today. But some members of Congress say those organizers deserve a lot of the credit for pressuring the White House to act.
Well, we got to this point because of the courage of a lot of low-wage workers who stood up and highlighted this issue.
That's Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders, one of the lawmakers who says they'll keep pushing this year for a national increase in wages.
The United States government should not be the largest employer in the country of terribly low-wage workers. What we have got to do now is use this as momentum to pass a national minimum wage and raise it from 7.25 to 10.10 an hour. So this is a good step forward, but we've got to keep up the momentum. I think we don't want people working 40 hours a week for starvation wages.
Some lawmakers, including Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren, say the measure doesn't go far enough. She points to a recent study showing the national minimum wage would be more than $22 an hour if it had kept pace with gains in worker productivity over the past few decades. And it would be near $33 an hour if it had kept pace with the rise in wages of the wealthiest 1%. But many Republican lawmakers and a handful of Democrats are opposing the president's action as going too far. Florida Republican Marco Rubio spoke to FSN about why he takes issue with the move.
And what is your concern about this measure?
The impact it'll have on small businesses and the hiring decisions they'll make as a result. Some may have to lay some people off or keep hiring some people because the increased amount they have to pay in wages might cause them not to hire people at a time of high underemployment.
Last year, Rubio came out in favor of abolishing the minimum wage altogether, and he's not the only one in his party to do so. Due in part to this political opposition, the bill to raise the federal minimum wage has been stuck in committee since it was introduced in March. But workers across the country, including steelworker Lee Medley from Galveston, Texas, say they'll keep the pressure on lawmakers until they set wages that fairly compensate Americans for their labor.
You know, myself personally, I believe the minimum wage should be tied to the cost of living. 10-10 is what, $21,010 a year? Have you tried to rent an apartment for $21,000 and feed your family and drive a car for that? I think we should be looking at a living wage, not a minimum wage.
In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Yearly mammograms for women may not be reducing the number of deaths caused by breast cancer. The conclusion from the decades-long study in Canada, which involved some 90,000 women, found the same number died of breast cancer over 25 years, regardless of whether they took an annual mammogram. To discuss how the findings could shape debate over the use of screening in the future, I spoke to Dr. Russell Harris, Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina.
We've had doubt for some time, and as you know, there has been a large debate about the value of screening mammograms for women in their 40s. And that's because the amount of benefit from those women, if any, is quite small, and yet there are clear harms as well that go along with it. I think what this study adds is that we should be also having the same doubts about screening women in their 50s. What this means for women is that they need to stop and think before just agreeing to have a mammogram. But they need to think about what the possible benefits are and what the possible harms and costs are that they might have to undergo.
And how will they be able to collect that information to make an informed decision on whether or not to go for a mammogram screening?
There are several places. One is, of course, their own physician. And for the physician, there are several places one might go. There is a recent publication by H. Gilbert Welch in a medical journal called JAMA Internal Medicine that gives a very nice table that shows how many women out of 1,000, if you're age 40, would have their lives extended by screening, and how many would have a false positive, and how many would be overdiagnosed, and then the same for women in their 50s and women in their 60s. That's the kind of information that I think women should think about. What this study does, however, is say that the number of women whose lives would be extended might be even less than is in the table.
But for so long, the case seems to have been that if you, as a woman, do not go for your annual mammogram, then your actions are almost irresponsible.
Isn't that something, how we've come to that without good evidence over many years? I think it shows that both the medical profession and the public has bought into the idea of screening, that finding things early should always improve things. That's just not the case. And we've gradually come to that understanding over the years so that now we understand a lot more that the things that we thought were helping people, that is just finding cancer, isn't necessarily helping people at all. And we're finding that sometimes by doing that intensive work to try to find every cancer, we're actually hurting people. We're finding cancers that would never have progressed, that did not need to be treated, and we're telling people they have cancer, which often uproots their lives, and then we're treating them, which also is a very difficult process. And so when you start balancing the things that you get versus the things that you have to give up, it sometimes is not a very good trade-off.
So in your professional opinion, then, how do you advise patients who come to see you on when you read a study like this? Does your professional line shift?
My professional line has long been to help women make their own decisions, and that has to do with providing them with the information that we talked about a few minutes ago in tables such as Dr. Welch's tables. Then some women, given that information, will say, you know, if there's any possibility that it might help me at all, then I'll go undergo screening. But other women look at it and say, you know, for the number of times when there will be a false alarm or the number of times when I might be overdiagnosed, I don't think that's a very good idea. And so I think different women will make different decisions, and I think that's appropriate and it's okay.
Dr. Russell Harris, Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina. Now, some of the hardest hit parts of South Sudan are finally receiving aid more than 2 months after fighting began. The United Nations has managed to reach Malakal in the Upper Nile State, where thousands of people are still without food or shelter. Nick Harper reports from the United Nations headquarters in New York.
Here in Malakal, aid is finally getting through. This is the first time the UN has been able to reach this remote area that's seen some of the heaviest fighting. In this region, 150,000 people have fled their homes, the largest concentration of displaced civilians anywhere in the country. Riak Tori left his home and escaped with his family. He says the aid has significantly helped.
This is the first assistance we've received since we arrived here, over 9 days ago. We used to sleep on the ground, but now we have a sleeping mat to sleep on and soap to wash our clothes with.
People find shelter where they can. Here it's an empty classroom in a deserted school, the playground used for cooking and washing. Mildred Uma is from the UN refugee agency, UNHCR.
The process has started. Our contribution of 10,000 for the 10,000 individuals targeting the most vulnerable has already begun and will go on for the next couple of days.
More peacekeepers have arrived, but the mission is not yet up to the 12,500 total agreed on by the Security Council in December. Meanwhile, the US State Department is calling on foreign troops to withdraw from the country to help the fragile peace process progress. Ugandan fighters are under pressure to leave. And there have been reports of continuing violence despite an agreed ceasefire. Last week, a UN team was called on to disarm a cluster bomb that was found on the main road between Juba and Bor. In New York, after briefing the Security Council, the head of peacekeeping operations, Hervé Ladsous, warned a report due in April will detail the full extent of more than 2 months of violence.
Clearly, we are working on human rights. You would imagine that after the thousands of victims, the number of cases that have to be investigated, it is not something that happens overnight, but we are taking this very, very seriously.
According to the latest UN estimates, there are now nearly 750,000 people who've left their homes. Here's UN spokesperson Martin Nertzky.
85% of displaced people are outside UN bases. Most families have lost any means of providing for themselves because of displacement, looting, and the destruction of their property. The office also says that humanitarian partners have assisted 300,000 displaced people, but most of those displaced have not yet received help because of continued insecurity. The office notes that even before the crisis, the humanitarian situation in South Sudan was critical, with more than 3 million people food insecure.
Peacekeepers are still pouring into the country to protect civilians and help get aid to those in need. But that's taking time. And with the truce between the government and the opposition barely holding, the country's troubles still seem far from over. Nick Harper at the United Nations in New York.
In death penalty cases, I'm not convinced equal justice is being served. The declaration from Washington State Governor Jay Inslee as he announced a suspension of state executions. His move follows a growing trend across the US towards the use of capital punishment. To discuss changing attitudes surrounding executions, I spoke to Richard Dieter, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center.
Still an unusual step in the sense that the death penalty is practiced in 32 states, so the majority of the country still supports it. But more and more leaders like the governor of Washington yesterday and before the governor of Oregon and Colorado said they just felt that executions could no longer go forward. The death penalty was too problematic, too much doubt about the risks of executing the innocent, failure of this being a deterrent, and high costs. All of this has led to a review of the death penalty, and I think we're seeing less executions, less death sentences. It's really a national trend, but still it takes courage to do that and stand up and say, I'm going to do what I can to get this debate moved forward.
But as you said, I mean, there are still 32 states that enforce the death penalty.
Yes, so.
So you've got that statistic. You've also got probably a backlash from Republicans in Washington state who would suggest that the governor's move, well, was a wrong one.
Oh, yeah. The death penalty is not really much part of our criminal justice system. That is, you know, crimes and punishments. You do certain crimes, you get this. It's much more part of the political process. It's a symbol or a substitute for certain ways of thinking about what the government should and shouldn't do. There'll be criticisms, but I don't think that this will be seen as, you know, way out of line. That there's just been too much exposure about innocent people being freed, about the unfairness of the death penalty. That some counties use it and other counties don't, and very horrendous crimes don't get the death penalty, and then some person who has a bad lawyer and, you know, the kind of case where a white victim is killed, that person gets the death penalty. These sorts of things are striking many people as unfair, and that's why the death penalty is under review.
And civil liberties groups certainly often point to evidence that the death penalty has been unevenly applied for many years in terms of be it race or economy, even geography.
Only 2% of the counties in the U.S. are responsible for most executions and most of the 3,000 people on death row. That's 2%. A few counties are using the death penalty a lot. Places, Dallas, Texas, or Houston, Texas, or Los Angeles, California have a lot of death sentences. Then you go to another county in the same state, in Austin, Texas, or San Francisco, same law. Within the same state, but no death sentences. You know, it's quite phenomenal the way it varies on which side of the county line you commit your crime on.
And of course, in terms of the method used in these executions, lethal injection has been in the spotlight recently because there's been some controversy and question over whether or not new cocktail of lethal injection drugs is actually effective. Or is perhaps causing unnecessary, prolonged, painful death.
Yeah, that is the latest problem that the death penalty has run into, that it's using a medical model of execution, that is lethal injection drugs, trying to make it appear antiseptic and like an operating room or like a high-tech sort of execution. But it involves the medical profession, and they simply, whether it be pharmaceutical companies or doctors who are the experts or anesthesiologists, pharmacists, really want to stand apart from this. This is not what their profession is about. Even skipping the morality of the death penalty, it's just a misuse of that kind of profession. So Europe has restricted the drugs for import. Pharmaceutical companies here have raised objections to, you know, these drugs are not made for killing. They're made for some other purpose, so don't use them. So states are scrambling. Four executions this year, the first four, used four different methods of lethal injection. In other words, it's an experiment. You know, states are trying different things to see what works.
Richard Dieter. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter, we're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Thursday, find out how far the US has slumped in an international league of press freedom. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Hume on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.